Oh, we are so close to being done with this week. Hey, Brett, it's Friday. How you doing?
Hi. In case you guys didn't notice, John will not be here next week.
I will not be here next week. The show will be.
Yeah, there will be a series of fill-ins, including.
So several of the episodes will be led by Brooke. You're going to be leading a few. Anna Kasparian is going to be on one day. JR, Francesca, I know we've got a bunch of great co-hosts that are going to be coming in throughout next week. And that's it for me. I'm gonna be gone.
And I want you, the viewer, listener, whatever, to just in the back of your mind think to yourself, John's almost on vacation. And see how see how it plays out in his presentation of the day's events.
Mm-hmm. Well, thankfully, the news is all just light and happy. So we should be good today. Why don't we talk about what we're gonna be talking about today? So a little bit later on, I've been wanting for several days to talk about this article on The Cut about incels and plastic surgery that is just fascinating. So we're gonna be having a little debate about that. We've got Laura Ingraham, who's just to be the worst on Fox News is difficult, but she's found a particular path that she's walking. And we've got great guests gonna be joining us to break down a new book, Life Scale, a little bit later on. A young climate activist is gonna join us to talk about a series of national actions that are gonna take place in just a couple of days. So lots of exciting stuff to get to, but you know what? We are actually gonna start things off a little bit light with The View and Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren was on The View and she was breaking down some of the areas of policy that she's pushing for in a primary candidacy. One was the wealth tax, and she had an amazing, concise explanation of what a wealth tax is and what it could actually pay for in America.
Proposal is a 2-cent wealth tax on the top 0.1%, your 50 millionth and first dollar. You got to pitch in 2 cents and 2 cents for everyone after that. And with that, we can cancel student loan debt for about 95% of the people who have it.
Wow. And now finally.
Do so much more. 2 cents. We can not only do that, we can also provide universal tuition-free technical school, 2-year college, and 4-year college for every one of our kids who wants to get an education. Plus, we can do universal child care for every baby age 0 to 5. Universal pre-K for every 3-year-old and 4-year-old in this country, and raise the wages of every child care worker and preschool teacher to the level.
You know what's going to happen.
So obviously the audience hated that idea, not receptive at all. No, there's lots of cheers for her. That's what you want. I mean, she's going there knowing that all of the candidates are trying to get on The View. Many of them are going on The View, and she was received very well.
Yes, she did very well on The View in general. She also on that appearance outlined her stance on impeachment very clearly.
Were the view audience receptive to impeachment?
But the View audience in the studio, because I am the resident View expert here, the View audience in the studio is very liberal. It's shot in New York, and they always receive Joy and Whoopi way
the
better
best
than they do, and Sunny. And you would see a great case in proving that is Jedediah Bila, who was on that show and then went to Fox and Friends. She, over her course of her being on the show The View, changed her delivery when she noticed that if she said more libertarian, liberal viewing things, she would get a better response. And now that she's on Fox and Friends, you do not hear that out of her.
And so because you are our expert, you were sort of joking about that, but you are.
I watched a lot.
So I have a follow-up question that will help us to analyze this presentation of the wealth tax. So you describe the audience as more liberal. Are they more liberal or are they more progressive?
The in-studio audience is more liberal. Mm-hmm. They're not
more
progressive.
More old school kind of liberal.
It's women who went through their moms. They're older skewing moms in the middle of the day. And they skew more like a women's liberation movement. Like, I fought very hard for this. Mm-hmm. I watched men tell me what to think all day. And now I have a show where I'm listening to women say things. And I'm glad about that.
Yeah, so I tend to watch this in clip form. Meghan McCain, does she often receive she received well?
She does not. She never receives a standing ovation. Now, that's not to say that the viewing audience of The View
is
more liberal or not. It's just that in studio, it is a hostile environment to Meghan McCain, and she doesn't make it any easier on herself by being an idiot surrounded by much smarter women in the audience mm-hmm. who can see through it.
Okay, and you're saying that as the expert. Let's just acknowledge that. Yeah. Okay, so the reason I wanted to bring that up was we were talking before the show about there you have the wealth tax received well. That's got to be a good sign because that's not something that we have. It's not something that generally been talked about a lot up until January of this year, and already it looks like that's pretty much an electoral winner. But they did talk about other topics, and one was her choosing not to do town halls on Fox. And I think she gave a very good explanation as to why she does not want to do that, having to do with the fact that Fox is, in a very real way, monetizing hate. And a Democratic candidate going on there would help them to make the case to advertisers. It's complicated. I'm not 100% in any direction on this.
That's right. She's right about that. Brooke did a good job of explaining that, too. Mm-hmm.
And so Meghan McCain was not having that. And one of my favorite things was they do reaction shots. So I'm Elizabeth Warren. I'm explaining why I'm not going to go on Fox. They shoot to you every once in a while. And she just has this angry, pinched face. Like she can't take that someone is disagreeing with her, even while being super nice. Like Elizabeth Warren was complimentary towards Meghan McCain.
Yes, because Elizabeth Warren is a decent person. Mm-hmm. Meghan McCain is going through a lot, much of which is her fault. The rest is exacerbated by the producers on the show who are reaping quite a benefit out of it.
And out of the conflict you're saying between her and the other hosts.
So Meghan McCain at any moment could say, that's enough, I am a laughingstock, which she is. She is a laughingstock. The producers make her a laughingstock. She's not smart enough to stop being a laughingstock. Mm-hmm. And that is the strange, sad alchemy of television, especially in the daytime. Mm-hmm. They have hot topics. They set it up to yell at each other. They give them little blue cards with facts on them. Mm-hmm. Someone who does their research, like Sunny Hostin, everyone who is smart on their feet and knows how to do stuff, they look at their cards occasionally. You'll see them put them down when they don't want to use things. Mm-hmm. Meghan thinks that these are her get out of jail free facts. Mm-hmm. And jail for her is thinking. So she doesn't have to think. So she looks at them. She'll get halfway through and sometimes realize that that was set up there and put there by a producer who realizes that she'll read anything on the card. Mm-hmm. She'll try to think that this is a defense. She doesn't have to come up with some kind of argument. And then everyone will systematically shoot her down. And in Meghan's mind, it's, they're all against me. But the truth is, yes, they are against you. But everyone else is just frustrated with you.
Just frustrated, yeah. Yeah, and so they had a little back and forth. I think Elizabeth Warren did quite well. I get your frustrations with her. I share those frustrations. I am a little bit worried, though, that if she did step down, there's a 25% chance that Tommy Lauren would end up on there.
It's so very, very possible.
Maybe this is better than the alternative.
She's taken her check. Don't feel bad for her.
No, not that bad. I'm feeling more bad for humanity as reflected through her actions and words. But with that said, why don't we turn to a little bit of foreign policy, interesting story we were talking about just a little bit yesterday having to do with North Korea. Donald Trump has been trying to get his diplomatic inroads with North Korea for over a year now. And the meetings haven't necessarily gone very well for America or for Donald Trump. But it turns out it's been going much worse for some of the negotiators on the North Korean side, according to South Korea's biggest newspaper, that reports that multiple of the negotiators have been killed by North Korea because of the failure to get a deal with the US. After the February summit in Vietnam, where Trump and Kim failed to reach a nuclear deal, the regime in March killed 5 diplomats by firing squad at a Pyongyang airport. So I guess they got back, they weren't even allowed to go home, and then were gunned down. Now, we're gonna give you more details on this. Bear in mind that this is not what I would consider incredibly well-sourced information. There had been other reporting earlier this year that sort of hinted at these sorts of things, but the specifics are relying on a single source, so just bear that in mind. So among those who were killed was Kim Hyok-chol, North Korea's top working-level nuclear negotiator, who served for months as America's key counterpart. Quote, he was accused of spying for the United States for poorly reporting on the negotiations without properly grasping US intentions. And so that seems to mean he didn't tell them enough about what happened in the room, and he didn't get a deal. It just sounds like he didn't get a deal, and so they killed him and 4 other people.
They don't want a deal. Mm-hmm. They want to do exactly what they've been doing.
You're talking about North Korea.
North Korea. Mm-hmm. They've always wanted to stay in power. Mm-hmm. That's where you draw the. That's where you can trace everything that Kim Jong-un does back to. Same mm-hmm. with his father. They want to stay in power, and they'll do everything to stay in power. And one thing you can do to stay in power is to stay active in negotiating with the Americans, and then use that to ease sanctions so that people don't starve. When people are starving less, you go back to doing the thing that will eventually allow you to ease sanctions, which is get more sanctions on you. It was a disingenuous bargaining system from the get-go. Mm-hmm. I don't doubt that they kill a bunch of people there. Mm-hmm. People are treated terribly.
Yeah, and one of the saddest things, other than the fact that people died for just trying to do their job, is that if this does get asked to Donald Trump, he's just going to defend the guy who ordered the executions. Right. Assuming that this reporting is accurate and we gave you all those caveats, he likes the guy who kills people for not getting him a deal. And by the way, Donald Trump has surrounded himself with people who, like, when I first saw this, I thought, man, if I was in that negotiating room in the future, wouldn't I be a little bit worried as a human that if I don't make a deal with this person, they will be killed? Mm. But take a look at this. Asked by ABC News about those reports, initial reporting on this on May 5th, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo smiled as he said, quote, "It does appear that the next time we have serious conversations that my counterpart will be someone else."
He seems like a real
That's
nice guy.
Insanity. He's like, oh, you know, I don't need to wait out North Korea. I just need to wait out you because you'll be killed.
It isn't that, though. Mm-hmm. Well, I need to wait out you because you'll
be killed. Like, I know. I'm not saying he personally thinks that necessarily, but he seems to think that it's funny that the people he negotiates with are murdered if there's no deal.
It's just the idea that his boss, Donald Trump, would love to have a setup like that. There's no doubt in my mind where he was like, if I don't like that person, I can have him killed. Mm-hmm. That's what the president wants.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, he's willing to just fire them for now. I think that's more humane. But yeah, this is a ridiculous, bizarre story.
Every time that Trump sides with Kim Jong-un against Biden, just realize what you're dealing with.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we're aware of that. Some people might not be. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back, we're going to be talking with the author, a new book. We'll give you all the details about it after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Quite a bit on the show recently, I've been talking about the stress that I've been experiencing, the burnout, the deep-seated existential dread and frustration with where my life is and where it's going. And we've got an author joining us who's written a book who might be able to help both me and, if you're experiencing symptoms like this, perhaps you as well. Brian Solis is the author of Life Scale, How to Live a More Creative, Productive, and Happy Life. Brian, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, thank you so much.
We're glad to have you on. So give us an idea of your mission when you set out to write this book. What was the problem that you were hoping to help solve?
Yeah, well, you know, I was trying to write my next book and I couldn't because I couldn't get to the depths of creativity that I used to, the focus, the creativity, and I don't know, just struggling, stress, anxiety, self-esteem. And I just decided to do all of the research to figure out what was going on because I didn't want to chalk it up to writer's block. And it turns out that our relationship with these things, they have dark effects. Mm-hmm. And they make you kind of focus more on the shallows. They make your body speed up. They make your brain speed up. It's producing all these different chemicals inside of us that none of us were really told this is what's happening. And it sort of like creates a relationship or a dependency, not unlike substance abuse. And once I got to the heart of that matter, I figured I was going to need a solution because there's certainly not a lot of talk about what to do about it.
So some of what you described there, the body and brain speeding up, sounds at least on a shallow level like it would be a good thing. I'm assuming that it's not. And it sounds like as you were doing this research, you found that you were being affected by these addiction-like symptoms when it comes to devices, I assume?
Yeah, I mean, it's super ironic because my day job as an analyst is studies disruptive technologies. I've been studying this stuff for almost 20 years. And to be affected by the stuff that I've been tracking and monitoring and sort of finding ways to use in business and industry and education, and then find that I was affected by this. And so then I thought, if I'm affected by it, then what's it doing to everyone? And that's when I realized I had to stop everything that I was doing and get to the bottom of it and then find a solution. And just a long story short, it's bigger than we realize. It's pushing us in new directions that we don't even realize, step by step, day by day. And once you get so far away from what your center of reference was, who you were before all of this stuff, you're now a completely new person living different things with all kinds of aspirations that aren't even real, friends that aren't even real, sharing experiences that aren't even lasting. Mm-hmm. And they all become sort of these standards of newfound success that aren't even making us happy.
You know, it's interesting. So you're describing something that I think is probably true of you, seems true of me, that we can think back to a time before we had, you know, these devices on us constantly and all of that. But I am curious, I don't know if this maybe was a part of your research. What about the generation that's so young that they didn't have a time that they can remember where they weren't constantly, you know, able to access this sort of information? Do you think that that's a different sort of problem, or can it be cured in the same sort of way?
That, I'm so glad you asked that. So there's two kinds of problems we have here. There's us who know what life was like before, and then there's the new generation who only know this. In that regard, things like anxiety, depression, self-esteem issues, learning disabilities, those things are just now starting to come to light, but they're super pronounced that we're not even giving, like, our doctors, our psychiatrists, our health and wellness communities aren't even prepared to deal with what's happening on this front. So both are issues that we have to deal with, but they need different solutions. And the thing that scares me the most, I have two little girls. The thing that scares me the most on the younger generation side is that parents, teachers, doctors, everybody is just, they don't realize the problem. In fact, a lot of them are perpetuating the problem. They're putting iPhones and iPads in their hands to kind of keep them busy while, you know, adults do other things. It's time for a lot of us to just kind of wake up and realize that really at the core of this isn't just about turning your phones off or deleting apps. I'm not going to. I need this. It's a matter of actually understanding what's happening and then taking a mindful and an intentional approach about how you're going to use this stuff in ways that make you happier and more productive, more creative, whatever it is. But that takes a human journey, a real honest look inside to figure out, hey, what is success? What is happiness? Why did I let myself get so distracted by these things? Why am I letting other people's lives dictate how I should feel or how I should live? And then taking control in a much more human way that says, hey, I'm taking control of my life. I am in the driver's seat, and this is how I'm going to use technology. And you guys can follow me if you want. But at the end of the day, I'm done playing this game.
You know, it's interesting because I was going to ask if, I'm trying to get an idea of how complex the solution might be. I mean, some people are responding to the sorts of stresses that you're talking about by not having a phone or something like that, like actually ridding themselves of some of the devices themselves. And you're implying that that's not necessary or not the solution. But what about people who are opting out of things like Facebook or Twitter? Is that the solution, or do you think that people should be willing to stay engaged on some level with these sorts of potential distractions and stresses, but to go about their day-to-day interaction with them in a different sort of way?
Good question. To each his own, right? I think what we're learning, though, is that deleting certain apps, at least if it's temporary, or going through detox, practicing mindfulness, or going to Burning Man, using productivity apps, Calm, Headspace, all of these things, they treat the symptoms, right? So what we're not spending a lot of time in is understanding that behind what makes these things addictive is called persuasive design. And there's a whole lot of tricks, and we could get into that at another time, that unlock six different chemicals in your body each time you use the phone. And those chemicals are the same types of reactions that our body, our brains have when we're treating any kind of substance or using any kind of substance, right? So what the solution is, and I'll just show you a quick image of it. It's not unlike the journey you take battling alcoholism or drug addiction or any kind of addiction. You have to go through these steps of that start with awareness and then rebuilding your life to understand, one, this is what's happening to you, but two, this is what to do about it. So you can actually then go back to Facebook or Twitter with a much more informed, mindful, intentional approach where they are actually productive to you now that you understand what's happening and what you're doing about it. But yeah, the solution was actually much closer to AA than it was with digital detox.
Interesting, very interesting. Well, look, this has arrived at the right time for me because I'm considering these sorts of things as well. And I appreciate you joining us on the show and breaking down your new book. The book is Life Scale, How to Live a More Creative, Productive, and Happy Life. Brian Soles, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, incels turning to plastic surgery to fix what they think their problems are. Brett and I are gonna break it down after this. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Brett, I wanna talk about incels.
What's up?
And I wanna ask, before we get into the details, because I read this really fascinating article on The Cut about incels, psychological and surgical attempts to fix what they see to be their problems. How often do you think about incels?
I don't very frequently think about incels. Mm-hmm. Only when one does mass murdery things.
Yeah, which I feel like there's been a little bit of time since that, which is good. But that's what's so interesting is that I don't, generally it's a reactive sort of thing. They get in the news, we talk about them. But the interesting gap is that they are thinking about it nonstop. Like it is an identity that is core to some people. And there's these online communities and things like that. We've talked about it before. Just in case you have gotten this far without knowing what an incel is, it's someone who is involuntarily celibate in their own mind, at the very least. And so let's talk about what The Cut found in their research of some of these online communities, and then also what some of the individuals are doing to become more attractive so that they feel like they have a chance of getting a mate or something like that. So they describe this first, that showered with attention, this is their views of women expressed on some of these places. Again, we're not talking about every individual or every forum, but this is the basic idea. Showered with attention on dating apps, favored by divorce courts, beloved by HR diversity initiatives, women had become a privileged class. The forums rarely mentioned wage gaps, pregnancy discrimination, or sexual violence, except in jest. And again, there is, you know, there's a range of these forums. Some have, there was one on, I think it might have been /r/incel on Reddit that was actually shut down because they were so frequently talking about wanting to commit acts of violence. That's the thing, you have sort of two parts to this. You have the recognition of these individuals that they are too unattractive to ever find someone who will be intimate with them. And then the lashing out against that society of starting to hate the women that they feel are rejecting them, feeling like some sort of violence might be a solution. And that is how you get some of the mass murderers that have stood out from the community.
Yeah, it's go get therapy. You have to go get therapy. This is not a healthy thing to do. There are a lot of people who go through these kinds of identity issues and face adversity and perceived adversity. Just go get therapy that way. You've got to, along the way, realize that this is not healthy behavior, specifically in these forums. For me, it always fascinates me, like the forums that they get into, they start echoing this like, yeah, Chad suck, women, they don't love us the way they should because we deserve it, man. Mm-hmm. And I'm ugly, I'm so ugly, I'm so ugly. There's another forum called just general pop culture that has said the absolute opposite, which has said, listen, Kevin James is gonna sleep with some hot women. And then it shows women how hot they have to be to land a stallion like Kevin James. Mm-hmm. Like that is the forum we're all in and all women are in.
Yes. So I'm glad that you brought up the forums because the issue I think is the solution could well be therapy. But the thing is, these forums have an ideology and they reinforce for each other that no, that's not the solution. We are talking about biological truths. There's no, Freud is not going to help you if science is saying you're too unattractive to ever get anyone. But let's get into that a little bit, because you mentioned Chads. I want to define a few of these things. In forum posts, incels classify Chads, these are the men who are attractive enough to ever get a person to sleep with them. By phenotype, they have a Celtic, Nordic, gracile, Mediterranean. I'm not even sure what that's a reference to.
Mediterranean.
And style. You could be a jock, a lumberjack, a vampire, a pretty boy. They repost scientists. So this is the thing where we get into their curiosity. They repost scientific research on the importance of symmetry and harmony and universal standards of beauty. They discuss the golden mask, a platonic ideal of a face designed by a California surgeon using the ratio of phi. That doesn't look like pi, but in any event, they believe that they have found sort of scientific truths that have defined their existence.
So great.
So now let's talk about the solutions.
Here, before you do that, I just want to say the variety in archetype of pretty person, there is so much variety that it undercuts your core argument.
There's jocks, you could be a lumberjack.
Lumberjacks, vampires, pretty boys. You're talking about all these different types of people who vary from like athletic, sweaty dude to like earthy guy of the forest to non-human, pallid specter man to pretty boy, which is feminine opposite of lumberjack.
Yeah. So you can be all of these different things.
Find your thing. Somewhere in between is just you being you and people like that more than if they found out you were on these things complaining about life.
Well, I want to talk about a couple of things that have been pursued to fix these problems, not therapy. So one individual that's profiled in this cut piece, which you should read, is a Truth for Lies. Truth for Lies friends hated Chad, but they were also convinced their lives would improve significantly if they could somehow become Chad. So they tried gym selling and steroid maxing. That's incel speak for bodybuilding and taking steroids. If you want to work out, I think that's a great idea. I would take the steroids.
I do this next one.
They tried jelking, that's penis stretching exercises, and mewing, chewing hard foods to bulk up the masseter muscles, said by British orthodontist Mike Mew to augment the jawline. They tried pulling on their faces to reshape them. They got into skincare. Again, if you want to moisturize, I think that that's a perfectly good idea. I just feel that it's very different from the other stuff.
You're an incel, dude.
And by the way, okay, let's talk about surgery, though, because that's where the article really gets interesting.
Were you going to say penis stretching a second ago?
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're getting into penis stretching, like, at that point,
don't.
They're in bed with you. Like, I would just relax a little bit. Anyway, so one cosmetic surgeon's range of services include shoulder widening and narrowing. The clavicle bones are broken, then reconstructed. Deltoid and quadriceps implants and rib removal. Some 10,000 blog posts on his website respond pragmatically to patients' queries. Do neck muscle implants exist? They could. Can my face be changed to look a lot like someone else? Perhaps. Am I too old for skull reshaping at 57? He's had patients who are over 70. What is the maximum size of testicular enlargement implants? The largest he's done is 7 centimeters in diameter. And they do that by taking out the testicles, wrapping them in like a donut-like gummy implant to double their size.
I know some guys.
That's not the solution to your problems.
I know some guys with giant testicles, and they... And it just makes your wiener look smaller.
Well, that's what the jelking is for.
You got to jelk and get the testicular implants.
Yeah, and so look, to some extent, we're joking. And look, I feel uncomfortable. I'm the bleeding heart, progressive, whatever. I feel bad because these people don't have physical problems, really.
You don't.
What they have are mental health problems. Yeah. They have body dysmorphia and things like that. And the issue and where we get into the dangerous part is this article largely, I believe could present a sort of sad image of these people where you feel bad for them. But the thing is, when that is coupled with violent misogyny, you not actually addressing your problems becomes an issue not just for you, but for other individuals.
So like a lot of people in society have body dysmorphia, and a lot of times it leads to people wanting to take control of it. And then I've read and talked to people who have eating disorders and psychologists who explain why, that happens, is it's an attempt to take control. The problem is if it happens in men do have eating disorders. It's very real. It happens a lot, body dysmorphia.
That's more common now.
But another thing that men do in order to control stuff is turn to violence. And that's where this gets really, really terrible. And I don't think the solution is to be like, yo, it's me, Chad. I think Brett is one of the terms. But it's me, Chad, you wuss bag, sack up and run your game. Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't help. Yeah. I think the answer is to say, I don't have the answers for you, but I think a suggestion might be your support group, your lookism support group is not a support group.
No.
You need to find an actual support group or therapy because, listen, there are many solutions to this perceived problem you have. One of them is to look at the problem a different way. And someone who's not on lookism.com, half of which are probably people who are trolling you into getting surgery, mm-hmm. irreparable, unreversible surgery.
Yeah.
Those people aren't supporting you. They're just trolls. So you need to turn to someone that is licensed to be of aid to you.
Exactly. Those groups are not designed to push a person up into the light. They're like the bodies in the swamp in Lord of the Rings. They're just trying to drag you deeper down with them. The solutions are going to be living a positive life, pursue your interests, meet people and engage with them in an honest, non-violent, non-inherently suspicious and hateful way. That's the solution. It's difficult to do for some people by themselves, but there are actual honest support groups, including therapists, who can help you to do that. But just, you know, like compressing yourself into a diamond of hatred and anger towards society is not the solution to literally any problem.
Yeah, just have completely unearned confidence. It's worked for me.
Exactly. Exactly. Make sketches, okay? It sort of helps. Anyway, we're going to take a short break. We come back. The climate crisis, we're going to talk about it after this. The activist-led nationwide effort to get our politicians to take climate crisis and climate breakdown seriously continues in the very near future with some nationwide actions that you might be able to get involved in. Joining us now to break it down, Katie Eder, the national lead of #IAmJuliana. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you on to talk about what's about to happen. So on June 1st, what's going on?
So yeah, on June 1st, young people all across the country will be holding local press conferences in their communities to show their solidarity with the 21 young people who are plaintiffs on the Juliana versus US case. They're suing the government for knowingly contributing to climate change for over five decades. So young people across the country are holding press conferences to share their stories of how climate change is impacting their lives and to stand in solidarity with the 21 young plaintiffs.
So I want to talk more about how people could possibly get involved in some of these actions. But first, a little bit more on the court case. So first of all, do you have any indication of how it might end up going? And also, what's the goal coming out of this? What are the people hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, so the case itself was actually filed in 2015. So it has been happening for many years now. And the government has continued to use delay tactic after delay tactic to try to get the case dismissed. So the case is actually yet to go to trial. But even though it hasn't gone to trial, the plaintiffs have continued to win. They have really amassed a large body of evidence that shows that the government is causing climate change and is violating our constitutional rights by doing so. So the upcoming June 4th hearing on Tuesday is going to decide whether or not the case goes to trial. And then it will also decide if the motion for an injunction that was filed by the plaintiffs to put a pause on all new fossil fuel infrastructure will be put into place while the case is in the appeal process, which is where it is right now. So that is a really big decision that will come out of that June 4th hearing, as well as hopefully setting a trial date. So we can see a win come from this landmark court case.
And hopefully the actions on June 1st will help people, especially in the media, to actually pay attention to this and to not ignore it as they have in the past. But in addition to the press conferences, you're going to be announcing some major campaigns that people could potentially get involved in. What are some of the forms that they'll take?
Yeah, young people all across the country, in addition to sharing their stories about how climate change has impacted them and talking about the Juliana case during their press conferences, will be announcing local, statewide, national initiatives that they're launching, that they'll be working on throughout the summer and after, to really make sure that we continue to see climate action being taken on all different levels. So we're seeing really creative things, as simple as asking everyone to go vegetarian on June 4th, the day of the hearing, to really amazing comprehensive statewide legislation that groups will be starting to push, styrofoam bans for local communities and municipalities, and trash cleanups on local levels. So we're really seeing all sorts of things that young people are announcing.
And so as you mentioned there that as young people are announcing it, so you are an activist, you are still young, but you've been involved in a number of different actions over the course of the past few years. What do you think about the role of youth-led activist groups in this particular topic over the past 6 months or so?
I think it's really exciting. You know, young people are always the catalyst for change when it comes to social movements. When young people get involved, something changes and something happens, and we really start to see an impact being made and action being taken. And for climate specifically, I think what's going to make this movement so successful and is what's making it so successful is that there is already so much really strong infrastructure in place, and there's a lot of ways that people can engage on all different levels with the climate movement. And so I think that young people now getting involved and really starting to kind of get into the media a little bit as well is going to help bring the attention that this movement needs and that has been building for a really long time to see action truly be taken to start to address the climate emergency.
So Katie, you say you're amassing stories of people sharing their experience on how climate change has kind of affected their lives. I'm curious as to what kind of stories there are, like what is an example of something that someone you've interacted with shared that really, you know, typifies the kind of effect that climate change has on their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's so unfortunate about where we are with the climate crisis is that young people in communities all across the country and all across the world are being hit by the effects of climate change in ways that we didn't expect, and we're going to continue to be hit by ways that we don't even totally comprehend now. I think, you know, the flooding that's happening right now in Oklahoma is a perfect example. It's not getting very much media coverage, but there are young people whose homes are underwater and who you know, are going to have to deal with those catastrophic effects for the rest of their lives. And that's taking away from their futures and all of our futures. And so that's really the message that we're trying to send is, you know, as a generation, we have the right to a future free from climate catastrophe. And if our global leaders aren't going to take action, then we're going to demand it until a change is made.
Well, Katie, good luck with the effort tomorrow. And we're going to be watching next week to see you know, how much the media pays attention to this incredibly important case as it continues forward. And we appreciate your activism.
Great. Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, last night, Laura Ingraham decided to use her platform to advance the interests of one of the worst anti-Semites in the country. We'll give you the details after this. Over the past year, Laura Ingraham's show has become more and more focused on the two pillars of the modern conservative movement, that is white supremacy and whining about social media. And so I want to show you a graphic that she put up on her show yesterday. Let's bring that up and you'll see a number of, quote, prominent voices censored on social media with quite a bit of range between them, by the way. So Brett, you'll immediately notice you have some just out and out conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones who have, you know, demonized the parents of kids who were shot in mass shootings. You know, Milo's a defender of pedophilia, down to like Laura Loomer, who is literally only known because she complains that Twitter's not nice to her. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge range there. James Woods, a guy who was like suspended.
James Woods is in my fraternity and Hassan's fraternity.
Okay, so I blame you to some extent.
We are brothers.
So to give you an idea of the range of things here, you've got Alex Jones, who's engaged in a court case for continual harassment of the parents of people who are killed in mass shootings, down to like James Woods, the guy whose Twitter account was suspended because he wouldn't take down a tweet saying that Mueller and all of his investigators should be hung. But then you've got
Hanged,
I don't know. Dan Scavino, who literally, I don't think he's been censored on social
media.
He's
Nazis, just a person. But you're being a grammar Nazi.
Exactly. And to Michelle Malkin, who I guess they just put her on there. Has she been banned?
Yeah, that was my biggest surprise. I was like, what's Clark Gregg doing? Oh, no, it's Dan Scavino.
Exactly. Now, and then, look, all of this is fun and whatever, but the issue is down in the bottom right corner. So Paul Nellen is probably a person that I would imagine a lot of people don't know who that is. And don't know why they're a prominent voice who should be defended by Laura Ingraham. So I want to give you an idea of who this person is that she is going out of her way to defend. So let's start with some light stuff. So here's a tweet he'd put out before he was banned from Twitter. I've compiled a list of verified Twitter users who have attacked me in just the last month alone for my America First positions. Of those 81 people, 74 are Jews, while only 7 are non-Jews, and he has a list.
By the way, many of the people he says are Jewish or not Jewish.
Let me just tell you one thing about Jews we don't like when you make lists of us.
Exactly, which is a thing that happens from time to time on Fox News.
Bad experiences.
So you've got a little bit of anti-Semitism there. We're going to return to that shortly. Jake Tapper reminded people of one thing he had done, which by the way, so there you see, he had tweeted, "Honey, does this tie make my face look pale?" Using that image of, I believe it was like a pre-Homo sapiens person in the UK in place of Meghan Markle.
Right, which is weird because isn't that what you say? Like, they're all English by that account.
I have no idea. But the idea is like racism. That's yes. The idea there. Now, this is a guy who had run he wanted to be in Congress as a Republican. The official Republican Party cut ties with him because he was too racist. He was banned from Twitter and Facebook. That's the easy stuff. Once you get banned there, you go to Gab. That's the far right version of social media. They banned him for being too extreme. And to give you an idea of how extreme he is, in April, he went on a podcast where he advocated for a race war and a preemptive nuclear strike on Israel. So he wants to murder everyone in Israel, whether he had two theories. One, that we should take a whole bunch of people like the guy who shot up the Tree of Life synagogue, march a million of them into Israel to murder everyone, or just nuke the entire country. That's what he wants. He also says that he hopes some group of chimped out N-words attacks white senior citizens, prompting anti-government groups to launch a counterattack. He posted a photo on Gab of him photoshopped in the White House, in the Oval Office, surrounded by Orthodox Jewish skulls mounted on pikes. So this is the guy that Laura Ingraham's like, he's just a prominent conservative. Why are social media sites being mean to him?
The social media sites are acting Christly. They are defending the Israelites, who are the seeds of Judeo-Christian ethos. And that is their religious right as companies to forward those Judeo-Christian ethics. Laura Ingraham is launching an all-out assault on Christianity by going after these people for living in Christ's image by blocking this hateful rhetoric.
Yes.
So Laura Ingraham hates God.
Well, clearly, she also has a very weird temperamental relationship with being opposed to anti-Semitism, because you might recall that she spent most of this year attacking Ilhan Omar for everything that Ilhan Omar has said and saying, how dare she say these anti-Semitic things. She is not the person you should be listening to. You should be listening to Paul Nehlen, a guy who wants to nuke Israel. So it's a weird sort of flip-flopping relationship with anti-Semitism, where she is a fan of the guy who wore, the guy who went into the Tree of Life synagogue and murdered people. He wore a t-shirt with that guy's face on it. This is the sort of anti-Semite that she believes is just a prominent voice that social media is being mean to.
It's not censorship.
It's not censorship at all. It's trying to avoid him organizing people in a way that will get people killed. So after all of this has come out, she's been criticized for this, and she knows what she's doing by putting that guy on the list. She tweeted this, "Retweeting screenshots of despicable old tweets by racists and or anti-Semites must make those racists and anti-Semites very happy. Unfortunately, it does zero to elevate the debate in America." Unlike what? Her show advocating for those people and calling them prominent voices, that elevates the discussion.
That's insane. Somehow. I don't even know how to wrap my head around that. Retweeting anti-Semitism.
I don't know what it means.
It does zero to elevate the debate in America. What debate? That's it. There
about
is no
whether
debate.
Nazis are good or bad. About whether Israel should be nuked or not.
Nazis
That's
bad.
The debate.
America won. Make America great again when we beat Nazis. That was great.
Pretty great.
You guys have all the tools. You use them in the dumbest ways possible. You have religious freedom arguments. That's fine. I love religious freedom. But you use that in the dumbest way. Use religious freedom and religious ethos to advocate for equality, yes, justice, freedoms.
Yes.
Not freedom, D-U-M-B. Exactly. It's Yahweh or the Hawaii.
Oh, jeez. Anyway, so Fox doesn't care if she does this. That's what she's there to do. It is a site where, it's a show, I should say, where you just advance the narratives of white supremacists and anti-Semites and then pretend that you care about Israel. But this is a reminder, again, I'm not 100% on this, but when people say maybe we shouldn't go on Fox News and help them raise money, they're a site of hate, this is the way that it's disseminated.
Yeah.
By just saying, hey, like horrible genocidal anti-Semites, they're just people like you and I.
It's so pathetic how much they need us.
We do have to go, though. Thank you for joining me on this Friday. Thank you for watching all week. Next week, a ton of great guest hosts coming on. So we'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.